Welcome back to the MJA podcast. I'm Kate Swanell. Transgender and gender diverse Australians face more barriers than most to quality healthcare. Misgendering and experiences of stigma in healthcare settings are common occurrences. Many doctors are keen to treat trans folk appropriately, but lack the knowledge and training. A group of West Australian authors has written a perspective in the MJA on the harms misgendering and structural stigma can do to trans and gender diverse people. One of the authors, Penelope Strauss, is a youth mental health researcher at Telethon Kids Institute and is one of my guests today. She is joined by Emery Wishart, Services Manager with Transfolk of WA. So my first question is a basic one. What is the difference between sex and gender?
Sex is assigned to everyone at birth and generally assigned based on chromosomal, gonadal and anatomical characteristics. So it's what is on your initial birth certificate that is given to you at birth, whereas gender forms part of an individual's personal and social identity. So everybody has gender. If your gender does align with that sex that was assigned to you at birth, you're known as cisgender, meaning that it matches. And if your gender does not match that sex assigned at birth, you're termed as either trans or gender diverse.
Can gender change over time?
Yes, so gender can be fluid for some people, especially young people. Sometimes it can take a while to realise one's gender identity. For other people, it's very fixed. So it really depends on the individual and everybody has a different experience of their own gender.
Okay. So how would you define misgendering?
So misgendering occurs when someone is addressed or described using language that does not match their gender identity. So that takes various forms. It can be direct, so person to person, you can directly use the wrong name, the wrong pronouns for somebody else, or yep. It can be sort of more structural and documented in forms where you are misgendered through that manner.
Is it sometimes things like, for example, my GP clinic wanted to do a survey of their patients and the only gender possibilities they had on the form was male and female? Is that misgendering as well?
Yes, so that would be a form of misgendering in that the individual's gender is not accurately represented on that form. Mm. So inherently, their individuality, their gender is not respected and acknowledged through that form. So yes, that is a form of misgendering.
Right. Emery, tell us a little bit about a trans person's experience of the healthcare system. How important is it to have good healthcare and how hard is it to get?
It's extremely important to have good healthcare for everybody. And unfortunately, I hear a lot of the time stories from other trans people, binary and non-binary, of them going to see a GP or going to the hospital and being continually using the wrong pronouns or using an incorrect name after they've been told the name that they want medical staff to use, or even getting really invasive personal questions that are completely irrelevant to the healthcare that they're needing when they present to the service. It's really quite common unless the health practitioner has a lot of experience and understands why misgendering is really harmful and why they should avoid it. I guess what happens then is I just hear a lot of stories of people not getting healthcare. Like at the first instance of say a problem or something coming up, they really avoid going and being a medical practitioner and delaying and getting that help.
Yes.
Which I think is really unfortunate.
How hard is it to find a GP, for example, who is trans friendly and who understands the whole notion of gender fluidity?
Definitely quite hard. Ends up happening. Part of my work is I'd talk to a lot of people in WA and a lot of online chats, and people let other trans people know what GP they see that is trans friendly, because there's so many instances where someone goes to a GP and the GP has no idea about how to treat a trans person and ends up being a really distressing, uncomfortable situation. It'll be a word of mouth and trans people will just hear from other trans people which GPs are safe to go to and which aren't.
Right.
And that can be a very small number of GPs. Or if people aren't linked in with the community really well, then they won't hear at all about trans-friendly GPs and they'll just continually be exposed to healthcare that isn't appropriate.
What we know from research is that when trans people access healthcare that is invalidating of their identity or otherwise somehow discriminatory, what happens is a lot of people later on avoid healthcare. And so what that means is screenings get missed, follow-up appointments get missed. And so what we see is that some health conditions that could have been treated earlier on aren't seen until much later, which does obviously lead to quite poor health outcomes for some people.
It seems to be that quite a few doctors want to know how to treat and how to care for trans people, but they just don't know where to go or what to do or say. Is this lack of education a structural problem with medical education?
I would say definitely.
Yeah.
I would love for health practitioners to be really educated about trans clients and their needs and just trans people in general. I feel like there's a lot of missing information, and so GPs can have the very best intentions and want to be very helpful, but yeah, as you said, have just no information about how to do that and what's respectful and what isn't. I think it's a priority and should be included in education, definitely.
I also think it's important to not believe everything that is found online, and so it's really important to GPs who do want to learn more to contact community organisations, to contact professional organisations such as the Australian Professional Association for Trans Health, who do run trainings, and mm-hmm. so to really start there with contacts to find out where they can get the most up-to-date information.
I'm chatting today with Penelope Strauss from Telethon Kids Institute and Emery Wishart from Transfolk of WA. Penelope's co-authored Perspective can be found at mja.com.au. The MJA has published two articles which may be of use to doctors treating trans patients. One is on the hormonal management of trans and gender diverse adults, and the other is standards of care and treatment guidelines for trans and gender diverse children and adolescents. Just go to mja.com.au and search on transgender. Check out our other podcasts at mja.com.au/podcasts or wherever you get your pods. Back to our chat. Let's talk a little bit about stigma, particularly structural stigma, because I think that's the one that we're most concerned about within a healthcare setting. Tell us a little bit about what is an example of structural stigma and whether or not that's put there deliberately or are we just talking about blind ignorance?
So it's a bit of both. With structural stigma, I mean, what we see is, as you brought up previously, with education lacking in trans health, that is a form of structural stigma where that ends up with doctors who are not prepared to care for trans patients who come to them, and many lack the knowledge of trans health. They don't know how to help their patients by referring on to specialists when needed or required.
Mm-hmm.
And they also may not be sure how to appropriately address trans patients who come to their clinic or practice. And so what that means is then obviously we end up with patients who feel discriminated against or misgendered, which can lead to poor health. And so that structural stigma does have a sort of carry-on effect to every individual. And it's really important that structural stigma does change so that the systems themselves are respecting of all trans, gender diverse identities, and that all staff within those clinics are also aware of how to address trans patients or how to sort of appropriately handle their day-to-day practice with all patients that come through the door.
I mean, we're talking things as basic as bathrooms, aren't we? Bathrooms, what ward a patient is assigned to, those kinds of things.
Yes.
I mean, the problem is obviously there. The question is, how do we fix it? How do we change things on the ground for trans folk?
I do have faith that things are slowly changing and improving, but mm-hmm. change does take time. And I think the primary point here is that for any health practice that does want to change the way they're doing things is to be led by local stakeholders, so local transgender diverse people.
Yep.
And then that needs to be backed by sort of system level reform and policies that really changes the structures around that health practice to make sure that everybody's respected.
Emery, are you as optimistic as Penelope?
Yeah, I think change mm-hmm. is coming. There's more and more visibility of trans and gender diverse people in the general community, in media,
mm-hmm.
in policy. People are becoming more aware and people want stuff to change. People want to be doing the right thing by trans people. So, yeah, I'm hopeful. I think there's a way to go, and it's still a bit of a process to get there.
Sure.
But there's a lot of good intention, and, like, change is, like, on the horizon, I feel.
Good. Penelope, what's a gender marker, and what issues surround them?
Gender marker is either a sex marker or a gender marker that is seen on patients' forms, on prescriptions, on notes that designates a patient's medical records. And it's often needed within medical practice with things like laboratory testing because those values are compared to norm values. And so the gender marker is often on many hospital records. And I think, again, primarily associated with that is the need to sort of explain to a patient why there's a gender marker there. And so if they've given a form that clearly displays their gender marker that does not match their gender identity because maybe they haven't gone through the legal process to legally change their gender,
mm-hmm.
That conversation does need to happen to show that the doctor and that health service does respect the patient's gender. And so things like if a letter is sent home to a patient's address, it's best to ask that patient how they want to receive physical correspondence and what name and title should be used on that mail. Otherwise, yeah, you may end up inadvertently revealing someone's gender history when they may not want to reveal that to whoever the person may see it there.
Yeah, gender markers and sex markers obviously exist, and like you said, it's about often with like blood testing and all that sort of stuff. Like something to keep in mind is like when they are really needed and when they aren't. Say in like in a hospital situation or in like a mental health ward, often a gender marker will be on the wristband that someone has to wear around all the time.
Exactly, yep.
I think in many circumstances it's quite unnecessary and can be like quite distressing. I think as well it's important to keep in mind that, yeah, a gender marker, some people are stealth and they might go to a new health clinic and just write M, for example, and have a trans history, and the clinic might not be aware of that at all. So I think it's like there's more questions around how gender and sex are recorded, like broader than just a gender marker, which doesn't always capture someone's history.
Emery, if you could wave a magic wand and change one thing right now, what would it be, do you think?
Proper training for GPs and health professionals. I think if there was real training that really encompassed a lot of missing content, that would be amazing and would really change the experience that trans and neurodiverse people have in healthcare.
What about you, Penelope?
I would love for all doctors to understand that respecting somebody's name and pronouns is just respecting that individual.
Yeah.
And I agree that training is needed, especially for things like hormones or how to refer somebody on or going through the informed consent process for various interventions. However, I think all of this comes back to when a patient shows up, listening to them, asking them how they'd like to be referred to, what name they use, what pronouns they use, and really sticking to that throughout every appointment, even if legally on their medical file something else is written, but respecting that patient face-to-face and using the name and pronouns that they use. I think the only other thing is that there are standards of care, both created for adults as well as specific to young people. And so Australia has their own Australian standards of care for trans children and adolescents.
Mm-hmm.
And then the World Professional Association for Transgender Health has sort of an overarching standards of care for all clinicians to use.
Is there a website GPs, for example, can go to that has a list of resources, specialists, and other support services?
So there's not one website that I know of. However, if a GP is not really sure where to start, I would say to contact the Australian Professional Association for Trans Health because there is quite an extensive network of clinicians. And so that's a good starting point. The standards of care online there. There's also a training that AusPath has developed for GPs within primary practice. So that I would also suggest looking that up, and I believe it's free. The other thing is that Dr. Irene Dolan, who wrote this article, who led this article, she has been working for Health Pathways for the WA Primary Health Alliance in Perth, creating a specific gender pathway. So the Health Pathways program does have specific pathways about gender and has advice on how to and when to refer patients on.
Emery, thanks so much for coming along and having a chat.
Yeah, no worries. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Penelope.
Thanks so much.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.